and Introduction to Krishna Consciousness. And I thought since Monday was a number of days ago and we have a couple of new faces, we can quickly go through that and come up to the place where we left off, with your permission. Is that all right? Permission? Thank you. So we start that I had an abiding interest in... Well, one thing I could point out before we go there is that in one sense this is a very superficial look at conversion, because we know that from Bhagavad Gita that people have acted piously in previous lifetimes and in this lifetime, and whose simple activities are eradicated and free from the duality of delusion, engage in Krishna's service with determination. So we're only dealing obviously with what we can perceive in one lifetime. We have no idea what went on before, which is very critical as far as this question of conversion. But in this case, I had an abiding interest in photography. All right, so I had an abiding interest in photography from a young age, 9 years old. And that interest continued onward. So I decided to major in photography in college. This is really primitive, I'm sorry. And in college, I did this term paper on close-up photography, and I took it to a publisher, and they agreed to publish it. This is an artichoke heart. Okay, so I was in my sophomore year of college, and somehow or other, no, I just advanced. So I met John Greiser in my sophomore year of college, and we spent that year together. And then the following year, he decided to do his master's thesis on the Hare Krishna people. And for that purpose, he went to India with the first group of devotees and Srila Prabhupada. That's it. Now we're in the fall of 1970. And he had many amazing experiences there. In the previous slide, we saw John Greiser with Srila Prabhupada in Bombay. And then he went with them to Surat. And in Surat, the whole town was closed down so that people could, they would read in the morning in the paper the route of the Harinam party, and people would line the streets of Surat and that particular area so they could glorify the devotees as they did Harinam. So it was an amazing experience for the devotees and for John as well. And these are some of the pictures that he took at that time. So, of course, in the West, the devotees had been ridiculed and ignored. And here they are being treated like heroes and heroines. All the townspeople came out. And also the devotees were invited to people's homes. They would, everywhere they would go, they'd be fed with amazing prasadam, so that they had trouble with digestion, and they had singing all day. They would have problems with their voices. So although it looks, it wasn't very amazing, it was also a bit austere for them in that sense. And Prabhupada was tireless in his preaching to the people. The devotees were amazed at his energy and his enthusiasm. And he said at that time that the people in Surat is part of Gujarat, a city in Gujarat. And he said in Gujarat it's like they compared them to dry grass just waiting for that spark of Krishna consciousness. They were already Krishna conscious, but when they saw the Westerners taking up their own culture, they became ecstatic with that sight, that vision. Here, this is Jamuna on the left distributing prasadam. And this is Prabhupada at Life Members, or this is actually before Life Members, just a supporter, a pious person. And he's very relaxed and happy to see the reception, taking prasadam there. Thank you. So from there, the devotees went on, along with John Gracer, they went on to the Allahabad Kumbh Mela. This Luther Mridanga on the right is Madhavisa, and you see on the far left is Madri, who was at that time Tamal Krishna Maharaj's wife. And in the Kumbh Mela also, they were very well received. The devotees were amazed by the sadhus that came down from the Himalayas, very austere sadhus. And the Shaivites, some of them that hadn't been out in public since the previous Kumbh Mela, you know, actually yogis. And there are also many bogus yogis as well. But it was quite a menagerie of people. And finally, when Prabhupada joined them, the devotees were very relieved as Prabhupada offered simple spiritual life rather than very austere, difficult approach to God consciousness. And one thing I forgot to mention last time was that it was very cold. You can see from the way they're dressed. This is now January. It's very cold at that time. And Prabhupada wanted Mangal Arati every morning. And some of the devotees found it too austere, and they would actually stay in their sleeping bags, all cozy and warm. And when Prabhupada became aware of this trend, although he himself was a little bit ill, he got up and he took a bucket of water. There was no heating at that time. It was just a pump where you pump out water from the Ganges. And he himself bathed in the early morning in the cold. And when the devotees understood what he had done, then they could no longer spend their own mornings in their sleeping bags. They all got up and went through that austerity also. At this time, Prabhupada was 75 years old. So this is Harinam at the Kumbh Mela. And it was simply three tents, one for the women, one for the men, and one for Srila Prabhupada, in a little corrugated area where the kitchen was, and they cooked very simply. And Prabhupada continued preaching and clarifying what is spiritual life. So at this time, John was writing to me letters about his experiences and inviting me to come to India. So eventually I did that. It was in March of 1971 now. I came to India, took all my savings out of the bank and went there and met up with John again after an adventure in London and Brussels. And, oh gosh. I think we might just try to go back to the old system. We can do that. Here we go. Okay, this is the old system, which we much preferred. All right. So here I am. I arrived in Mumbai, and I'm just in time for the Cross Maidan Festival, organized under the direct supervision of Srila Prabhupada. He personally, in other areas of the world, Prabhupada would give ideas to his leaders, and they would execute them. But in India, Prabhupada not only gave the ideas, but he showed them every step of the way how to execute them, and he also supervised every aspect of the execution, especially the spending of money, because there's a great tendency to be cheated in India if you're a Westerner. So he organized this incredible Cross Maidan Festival. It was advertised throughout the city with big, big banners all over the roads and in the newspapers. It was an 8-day festival. And they built a pandal in the center of the city for 30,000 to accommodate 30,000 people. This is the famous festival that Bharanath Swami also attended. So somehow or other I was sitting on the stage, because as far as I could see, everybody in the audience was Indian. And on the stage everyone was Caucasian except for Srila Prabhupada. So I was watching, you know, these goings on, quite astonished by the event and by the reverence of the people of India to Srila Prabhupada and to the devotees. These are some scenes from Bombay at that time. So this is at the Pandal, the last day of the Pandal. They had this wedding. An Australian married a Swede. And the Pandal, which, as I said, accommodated 30,000, they couldn't fit in. It was way beyond 30,000 people. They just were so enthralled by this wedding, the marriage. And when Prabhupada said at the end of the ceremony, he said, "This is the real United Nation," everyone erupted in cheers. I couldn't believe it. So at this time, the devotees had rented an apartment on the 7th floor of Akash Ganga building, which is on Marine Drive in Bombay, overlooking the ocean. And John and I went there. Prabhupada was going to leave to continue his travels. John and I went there because we had this idea to do a story on a quaint Indian village. And we didn't know which Indian village to go to, so we thought to ask Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada looked at us and said, "You don't speak the language. Wherever you go, they'll simply cheat you and steal your cameras." And we were quite crestfallen. And then he said, "Better that you go to Vrindavan and do your story there." So we didn't go directly to Vrindavan. First we went to Nepal and trekked for about three or four weeks in Nepal. And there I tried to read Bhagavad Gita, but failed to understand it, although I had some appreciation for it. So this is part of our trekking around. And then we finally went to Vrindavan. Now we're in July 1971, and we spent a month there. And I had been a hardcore atheist, and it was really, of course, it's a combination of things. We're looking at conversion. So conversion, there's two factors. One is that you get pushed by the material energy. You feel dissatisfied for some reason or other with the material energy, kicked it in one sense. And another, you get pulled by different aspects of Krishna consciousness. It could be prasadam, it could be the philosophy, it could be the devotees, it could be the deities. And all these things work together, and it's not very clear cut, because even though you're pushed by the material energy, still it's like an old shoe that's so comfortable, and there's still pleasure there that you don't want to give up. And even though you're pulled in so many ways by aspects of Krishna consciousness, still there's some things that make you a little bit reserved. I don't know, some of the devotees are a little nutty, or whatever it is. So it's a tension. And here in Vrindavan, I had this experience of, for the first time in my life, thinking maybe there is something to this God consciousness stuff. Maybe there is a God, because the people were so pious, and the whole atmosphere, even myself, I couldn't miss the ether being spiritualized. It's such a different experience just entering the precincts of Vrindavan. So we went around and we were exposed to many types of people. And especially, of course, the pious people there in Vrindavan and the beautiful cows. And what influenced me very much also was I would go and sit with the women who were chanting the Maha Mantra. They spent 3 hours each morning chanting. These are those very women, some of them. And I was just so moved by their sincerity. Even though, as far as I remember, they had no instruments and their voices were not very melodious, but they were just so impassioned, so crying out for Krishna, that I was deeply moved by that. This is a Bhagavatam class at Radhakund. And here's another example of the piety of the residents. And everywhere you looked, there was Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. This is on the Parikrama path, worshipping the Jamuna River, Raman Reti, Gurudan Hill, Radhagopinath, and the Parikrama path, which apparently looks very different today. So that was an extraordinary experience. And from there we were called away to Calcutta. Gurdas was one of the people that came through Vrindavan, and he asked John and I had come to Calcutta to help make a Vyasa Pooj book in honor of Srila Prabhupada's appearance day coming up in September. So, reluctantly, I left Vrindavan with John, and we moved into this Calcutta temple, which is a great trial for us, for me especially. As I mentioned last time, there was always difficulty there in terms of substandard prasadam, in terms of the cleanliness of the temple, in terms of the devotees getting on with each other, in terms of the austerities. It was a very difficult time, and I was pulling out my application sheets from Rochester Institute of Technology, ready to fill them out and go back to school. I'd only been in school 2 years. I had 2 years left to complete the final degree. And Chitralekha said, "You can't leave now because Prabhupada is coming." So I waited till the 25th of October, 1971, and Prabhupada actually arrived in Calcutta. So some other scenes from there. It's a temple room. And Prabhupada called for an Istagosti in Calcutta. He insisted that every last person come, and he waited till everyone was there. And then he spoke with such eloquence and potency, just the basic philosophy of tolerating difficulties. And he gave an example from his own life, how he came to New York, he had nothing. He was staying with a drug-crazed hippie who eventually attacked him. And Prabhupada had to run out in the street with literally nothing but his clothes. But he didn't give up, he went on, he was tolerant. So he asked the same of us. And that for me was a very moving experience. Even to this day, the temple in Calcutta is in the same place. And when I walk into Prabhupada's room in that temple, I remember the spot where I sat for that Istagosti. It was such a profound episode in my life. So this picture, probably you've seen it before, someone has made it into a line drawing, but there was a devotee at the Calcutta temple named Devananda Swami, and he was in Prabhupada's room telling Prabhupada the difficulties in the Calcutta temple. And Prabhupada this was his expression at that time, listening. There's actually about three or four other pictures taken at the same time. So John, after that Istagosti, John decided to get initiated. And he became Yadubhara Das. And this is the point where we stopped last time. So we can continue from that point now. I'm sorry for those of you who had already been through that. It's another, he's actually getting his beads and making his vows. So from there, Prabhupada went to Delhi. And he's greeted by the mayor of Delhi. His name is, his nickname, I guess, is Lalaji. And it was a great fanfare because by this time, you figure all the places Prabhupada has been. You know, he's been to Surat, he was at Indore, he was at Banaras, of course in Calcutta and Bombay. And now here he is coming to Delhi. And he's created a stir in India. People are aware of what he's doing and his Western disciples. And so the mayor comes to greet him at the airport. So we can catch up with this, perhaps. Also, the devotees had prepared another large pandal, very similar to the one in Bombay. And just after Prabhupada arrives, he sits under the sun, the Indian winter sun, squinting. And he explains to the Indian people that it's their responsibility to spread Lord Chaitanya's movement around the world. It's Lord Chaitanya's instruction to them. And then he has this amazing interview with a reporter, which I have here. Because the people are a little bewildered what Prabhupada is preaching, even though it's their own culture. The reporter says, "So, sir, are we rightly understanding that by Krishna you mean some eternal principle?" Prabhupada, "Not a principle, a person, like you, like me." Reporter, "A person?" Prabhupada, "Yes, just as you are talking with me and I am talking with you, you are a person and I am a person. Similarly, Krishna is a person." Reporter, "Person in the ordinary sense of the word?" Prabhupada, "No, he is the supreme person." Reporter, "Supreme?" Prabhupada, "Yes, just like we are sitting here in Delhi." Now here is Lalaji. Now he's referring to the mayor of Delhi, Lalaji. "He is the supreme personality, the mayor." So the reporters laugh at this kind of analogy. Reporter, so we can see and feel and touch him? Prabhupada, no. I'm giving an example. In India, the president is the supreme personality. You have to admit it. You may accept him or not accept him, but officially you have to admit it. So in this cosmic manifestation, there must be a supreme personality. That is Krishna. That is confirmed by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. Mato parataram nanyat kinchit asti dhananjana. There is no superior personality than me, and we accept it. That is our Krishna consciousness. Oh, Krishna is the supreme person. Our knowledge is very easy. We don't research. Krishna says that he is the supreme personality, and we accept it. That's all. It is very simple. Reporter, can we see him just as we see Lalaji? Prabhupada, why not? Reporter, but with these eyes? Prabhupada, yes, with these eyes. Simply you have to purify yourself, just like we can see Lalaji here. But if he goes in the street, nobody may recognize him. So if a person does not know Lalaji, then even if Lalaji meets him, that person does not see him. Why? Reporter, question of eyes and knowing, sir. Prabhupada, yes. Then he has to prepare his eyes to see Lalaji. Reporter, so sir, how do we prepare our eyes to do that? Prabhupada, it is easy. It is easy. Suppose you say that I have never seen Lalaji. And if I say, here's Lalaji, why don't you see? And if you accept, what is the difficulty? If you can say, no, I cannot believe you, I don't think that he is Lalaji, why is Lalaji walking on the street? He must be in a big, nice car. If you put all these arguments, then it is very difficult for you. But if you believe me that here is Lalaji, then the matter is very simple. Reporter, the question is faith. Prabhupada, it is not faith. When I say here is Lalaji, it is not faith. It is a fact. So Prabhupada was just so staunchly convinced that his conviction just radiated from him and influenced even reporters and everyone else. So here I have a reflection that I wrote in these memoirs. Srila Prabhupada asks everyone to accept that Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead and that we are not our body, mind, or intelligence, but spiritual beings that are an integral part of Krishna. Just theoretically accepting these two points cannot be compared to, for example, leaving the comfort and familiarity of the U.S. and entering the startling experience of India. Neither is it like renouncing material possessions and living a pristine, unencumbered monk-like life. The Krishna consciousness that Srila Prabhupada presents is like a tsunami. Everyone knows what a tsunami is? That enormous wave. Somewhere in the depths of my faithlessness, there had been an earthquake, and a massive change, scarcely noticeable on the surface, is racing towards the beach of my life. I can sense the swell, but I don't know where to run, where to hide, what to do. Something far beyond my capacity to understand is unavoidably emerging in front of me, irrepressibly beautiful and logical and compelling and overwhelming. So, this, you know, all these things, not talking about conversion, we have Prabhupada's incredible conviction before me and his example of Krishna consciousness, which is impossible to avoid. So, from here we go to this Pandal program in Delhi. I can read to you Satsrupa Maharaj's description of that Pandal program. If I'm going too slowly, I can speed up at any time. Is everybody okay with the pace? The devotees had secured an excellent location at the LIC grounds in Connaught Place, the heart of New Delhi's commercial district. They arranged for a large tent and prasadam distribution, and they had programs in the morning and evening before deities of Radha and Krishna that had just arrived from Jaipur. So attendance picks up, and the pious people of Delhi start attending this evening festival especially. And tens of thousands have come specifically to see the American Vaishnavas and American and European Vaishnavas. At Prabhupada's arrival, hundreds of people surged forth to touch his feet and receive his blessings as a ring of disciples escorted him through the crowd. Prabhupada, wearing a wool chadar, his Swami hat pushed back casually on his head, moved calmly forward toward the stage with natural aristocratic poise. He sat on the Vyasasana and the audience quieted. New Delhi's mayor spoke first. He had met Prabhupada in the early 1960s when Prabhupada had approached him for a donation to publish the first volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam. The mayor recognized Prabhupada as someone sincere and near to God, and had helped Prabhupada. And Prabhupada later presented him with complimentary copies of the first two volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam. The mayor was impressed by Prabhupada's success in spreading Vaishnavism in the West, and as he introduced Srila Prabhupada, he expounded on the Krishna conscious philosophy he had read in Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavatams. He spoke in Hindi, and he said, this is very profound. As mayor of Delhi for 5 years, he had many times welcomed important visitors and delivered addresses, but such functions are usually only formalities. This was not, however, the case with Srila Prabhupada. He said, since no one he had ever known could compare with Srila Prabhupada, he praised Prabhupada for doing immense amount of good work in India and the whole world. The mayor said, Srila Prabhupada has also given me love and affection, and I am more affected by him than by anyone else. Mayor Doe. So then Prabhupada spoke, and he decided to speak in English, addressing the audience, thanking them for participating in the Krishna consciousness movement, and explaining the basic philosophy about Dharma as the actual occupation of all living entities, is to serve the Supreme Lord rather than to serve the body. And this pandal went on for 10 days. And at one point in this procedure, this pandal, Prabhupada finished speaking and he tried to leave the stage and he was thronged with people. Although Prabhupada's disciples were already convinced of his greatness, that greatness took on a vivid reality at times like this, when they heard him speaking so powerfully and saw him surrounded by throngs of worshippers. As Prabhupada proceeded to his car, he remained calm and humble, with the disciples surrounding him tensed to protect him from being jostled by a frantic crowd. Yet despite the devotees' sincere attempts, individuals in the crowd would manage to break through, diving between the devotees' legs to throw themselves at Srila Prabhupada's feet. Prabhupada said, do you know why they are worshipping me? It is because I am free from sex desire. So this went on for 10 days and nights, Prabhupada speaking at the pandal. He says, the Krishna consciousness movement is the topmost yoga system. It is scientific. Don't think it is a sentimental movement. It is authorized, supported by the Vedic literatures. And actually, it is becoming effective. Religion is to surrender to God. These boys and girls have taken to this real religion. This movement is so important, and we are giving everyone a chance to make this life successful. Therefore, our humble request is that you join this Krishna consciousness movement. So this had a powerful effect on the people of Delhi at that time. The newspapers would often carry a summary of Prabhupada's talk at the pandal. But Prabhupada, I was going through my own evolution, you could say. And sometimes Prabhupada would speak very freely about not only the scientific aspect of Krishna consciousness and the logical aspect, but he would speak about how there was a sun god, Vivaswan, and Vivaswan spoke to his son, Manu, and Manu spoke to Ikshvaku. And I would be there, you know, wondering, is this, you know, mythology, like Greek mythology? So I had a problem. You know, on the one hand, there was a very uplifting philosophy that I could really connect to. And on the other hand, there was these outlandish statements that Prabhupada would make. But it was outlandish to me. None of the people in the audience had any problem with these concepts that Prabhupada was presenting. Although to me it seemed very unscientific, these statements. I had to start to wonder about the line that I was drawing personally within myself about what is scientific, what is logical, and what is illogical and unscientific. It became a tension within me. And I started to wonder, am I qualified to draw this line? Who am I to make these distinctions? So we were living in Delhi in a dharmshala, quite a nice place, spacious place. I was staying in the woman's ashram there. And at that time, Jamuna had arranged for the deities that we were worshipping at the pandal, very elaborate, beautiful arrangements. And she had overworked herself and was quite sick. So in this dharmshala, there was a walk-in closet, which was maybe 10 feet long and 5 feet wide, and she had started to reside there just to be away from the confusion in the ashram itself. And I was sitting with her one day, just seeing if there was anything that she wanted. And all of a sudden, we hear this very soft noise, and Srila Prabhupada had come out of his room and was walking into this closet to see Jamuna, because he had heard that she was ill, and he wanted to talk to her himself. So Jamuna was lying down, and she rolled over to offer her prostrated dandavats. And Prabhupada said, you know, what's wrong? Is everything you need? This room isn't so good. There's no air. It was big enough, but they didn't have any air because it was a closet. And he suggested that she move to another room closer to where he was staying. So seeing his sensitivity towards his disciples and his care for his disciples was also a very moving experience for me. And to see her love, Jamuna's love for him. So as I understood more about Srila Prabhupada and how he was not a self-appointed saint, but rather he was requested by his spiritual master to bring this knowledge to the West. It's not that he stood up one day and said, I'm going to do it, but rather he was following in a long lineage. And then also I read something by Dr. Thomas Hopkins, who was the chairman of the Department of Religious Studies at Franklin and Marshall College. Now this is an objective non-devotee observation of Srila Prabhupada. And this is what he wrote about Prabhupada's story. It's an astonishing story. If someone told you a story like this, you wouldn't believe it. Here's this person, he's 70 years old. He goes to a country where he's never been before. He doesn't know anybody there. He has no money. He has no contacts. He has no contracts. He has none of these things you would say that would make for success. He's going to recruit people not on a systematic basis, but just picking up whoever he comes across. There are precedents. Perhaps Jesus of Nazareth went around saying, come with me and be my disciple. But in this case, he wasn't an old man in a strange society, dealing with people whose backgrounds were totally different from his own. Bhaktivedanta Swami's achievement, then, must be seen as unique. So it was something truly extraordinary. I wrote in my memoirs, Srila Prabhupada is uniquely enigmatic. That means he's a positive puzzle. Although he stands only 5 feet 4 inches, he defies measurement. Very often when devotees give their memories of Prabhupada, they say that the first time they saw him, they were surprised at how short he was. Most of us could see well over his head. Yet it's impossible to think of him as a small person. He's utterly serious, yet lighthearted, deeply philosophical, learned and intelligent, yet has a childlike innocence. He's courageous, yet sensitive, truthful, yet compassionate, tolerant and flexible, yet self-controlled and determined, keenly discerning, yet gentle and forgiving. Born in a family of devotees of Lord Krishna, empowered by his spiritual preceptor and ennobled by his lofty mission, Prabhupada's faith is so immovable, so staunch, that it is not belief, but the substance of things unseen by me. Being in his presence is being in the presence of something beyond him that is immeasurably great. Being in his presence is electrifying, yet with all of this, he is prideless. Prideless, without pride, humble. And he is truly selfless, and he truly selflessly cares about us. He even cares about me. He sees the intrinsic dignity of each and every individual, for he knows who we are. This is Prabhupada on a walk. So, in Delhi, we were joined by a devotee named Bhavananda. I mentioned last time that I had first met Bhavananda in the temple. Very strongly, and I had not reacted favorably to that preaching. That was one of the, you know, when you come to the pushes and pulls, that was not a favorable experience. So Bhavananda comes to Delhi, and at this point he's taken sannyas. And just accidentally, one afternoon, I overheard him telling some other devotees that if Yadavara John, who became Yadavara, he was wearing this white cloth. So Bhavananda tells these other devotees, if John doesn't change to saffron cloth, I'm going to rip those white cloth off him myself and wrap them up in saffron. Because we were not married, but we were associating. Bhavananda thought it was very inappropriate, our relationship, John and mine. So that was very startling and disconcerting for me. And I had to compare that in my mind to the way Prabhupada approached the exact same issue. So when Bhavananda was not present, Yadavara and I were with Prabhupada in Calcutta for about 2.5 weeks. And in Calcutta, Prabhupada, he saw us regularly and he wouldn't address this issue of our relationship. He just didn't address it. But when he sat on the Vyasa sign, sometimes he would get very intense in his lectures. He would close his eyes and lean forward into the microphone. Right? And at least once he said something like this. This man and woman living together, unmarried, this is not civilized life. This is animal life. No commitment, no loyalty. In the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, this boyfriend-girlfriend is mentioned. It is a symptom of this age of quarrel and hypocrisy. Human life means that the boy and girl must get married and live together peacefully in Krishna consciousness. So I was sitting there in the Calcutta temple, you know, and I have this fuzzy idea, maybe what he's saying is somehow related to me. Maybe, maybe not. But although he had many opportunities to say something directly, he never did, which was actually very attractive. You know, he let it evolve in our own consciousness. So we were sitting in his room in Calcutta once, and this was before Yadavara was initiated. And it was a very casual moment, and John said, maybe Jean and I should get married. And Prabhupada said, yes, that's a good idea. So there was no force. He let it come from us, which is, of course, the best place for it to come from us, and to try to evoke that feeling of doing the right thing. And once it comes from you, then it's, of course, much more long-lasting than if someone rips off your white clothes and puts on saffron clothes. So then there was this incident. The pandal was going on, and we had an incident here. This was a very unusual occasion, but there was a hippie in the audience of the Delhi pandal, and he had around his neck a miniature framed picture of Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva coming from a chain around his neck. Right? And he pushed himself. Actually, what Satsrup Maharaj has written here is a little different from the way that I remembered it and, you know, wrote it, but I'm going to defer to his presentation as the authorized biography. So, because this, unfortunately, Prabhupada spoke for about 10 days, but there's only about 4 that ever reached the archive. Somehow, 6 of them never made it there. So this was actually from people's memories of this. It's not recorded. So this, the devotees at first tried to stop this hippie young man, this Caucasian, right? But Prabhupada said, no, it's okay. And he lets the boy have a microphone. And this boy, he first says, very aggressively, have you realized yourself, to Srila Prabhupada? Have you realized the soul in the innermost depths of your being? Yes, Srila Prabhupada. So at first this man was taken aback, but then he came back with another question. When was the Bhagavad Gita written? And Prabhupada refused to answer. Actually, what I remember, I guess we can compare it. This boy was saying that, Prabhupada, in your lectures, you say the Bhagavad Gita is 5,000 years old, but I've been doing studies on this subject, and actually the Bhagavad Gita is only 1,500 years old. And he made a very strong point about that. So, Prabhupada refused to answer, according to this version. Prabhupada said, now you answer my question. What is the process of receiving knowledge from Bhagavad Gita? The man said, no, first you tell me. When was the Bhagavad Gita written? According to my authorities, your assessment is incorrect. And at that point, Prabhupada raised his voice, and he said, I am not your servant, I am Krishna's servant. You must answer my question. And the heated argument became back and forth, the hippie yelling at Prabhupada and Prabhupada yelling back. And finally the devotees escorted this hippie off the stage. But the audience was in turmoil. I was in the audience at that time, and many people were very confused, and a good number were quite critical, saying that a saintly person should not get angry. And Prabhupada had gotten angry. So there was confusion also amongst the devotees why Prabhupada had allowed that hippie to take the microphone and speak on the stage. And our realization finally was that Prabhupada was impressing upon us that there is a procedure for understanding the Bhagavad Gita and all the Vedic literatures, and it starts with humility. And if we fail to have humility, we will fail in our understanding of this great culture. Culture rests on humility. Once you lack humility, you have no access to the entire Vedic culture. So it's a very profound moment for us, learning that lesson. After that, each day the devotees would arrange to have a very prominent person speak to introduce Srila Prabhupada. And one of those people was the Canadian High Commissioner, James George. First, Mr. George spoke with Prabhupada behind the pandal. There was a private room. And after speaking with Prabhupada, he came on the stage and introduced Prabhupada to the crowd. He said, for several years I've been wanting to meet the Swami and see what it was about him that was affecting so many of our young people in Canada and North America. I was very happy this evening to come in response to your kind invitation, and especially to meet Swamiji. I think, as he himself said to me a short time ago, there is something really happening. Whether he is doing it or it's being done through him, as he said, is beside the point. But there is something happening, and everyone who doubts that should be here tonight to see this. It is happening not only here in Delhi, but it's happening in Toronto and Cleveland and Los Angeles and New York and all sorts of places. What is it? I don't know how he would answer that question. For me, at a deeper level, what is happening is the awakening of a search. So then Prabhupada spoke, and he addressed this Canadian High Commissioner. He said, here, our Honorable High Commissioner of Canada is present. I request that since you have come to our country, please try to understand this philosophy. I have traveled your country, Canada, also. And as you've already mentioned, we have got branches in Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, Hamilton, Ottawa. So the boys are struggling. They're distributing culture, these books. And I'm getting very encouraging reports. Many young men are also coming. It is a very great scientific movement. So I impressed you to inform your government to give these boys facility to inject this Krishna consciousness movement in your country. So in that way, something like that would happen every day. And it was a smashing success from all points of view. And after that Delhi Pandal, at this point, as I mentioned, Prabhupada had been to so many cities in India, but as yet he had not taken his disciples to Vrindavan. So Prabhupada decided to take this group of about 40 people to Vrindavan. And he himself was at the helm. At first he went in a private car and all of us went in a bus. But as fate would have it, his car broke down on the way there, and so Prabhupada came on the bus with us and sat in the front seat on the way to Vrindavan. So Tejas was there. He says, after Prabhupada's car broke down, he rode the rest of the way with us in the bus. Our relationship with Prabhupada was very reverential. Although we were in the most intimate situation, staying with him and traveling with him in a bus, Prabhupada never said anything about it. In those days, we were actually very much like a family. Prabhupada knew everyone, and everyone knew Prabhupada, and would talk to him. But still, we were very reverential. Which is very, very true. We never became familiar, you could say, even though we were so close. This is Srila Prabhupada at his quarters at the Radha-Damodara temple, his old quarters. We didn't actually stay there at this time. We stayed in a place called Saraf Bhavan, which last time I was in Vrindavan was just being torn down. It's off the, if you go on the Chittikara road and then kept going, it was along that road. But anyway, it's no longer there. But Mr. Saraf had donated it for our use. And as I say, Prabhupada had made such a stir in India that everyone knew about us, and in Vrindavan it was like the homecoming boy. The great child of Vrindavan was now coming home as the tremendous success to his credit. And Prabhupada was welcomed by the municipality of Vrindavan. There was a formal reception. And this is what they said to him. O great soul, today we, the inhabitants of Vrindavan, known as Brijvasis, all combinedly offer our humble welcome to your holiness in this holy place of Vrindavan. And in doing so, we feel very proud. For many years, you stayed in the Radha Damodara temple and worshipped Her Majesty Srimati Radharani in a meditative mood. And thus, you now have the transcendental vision to deliver the entire world. As proof of your perfection, we can see these foreign devotees before us, and we feel very proud to see how you have transformed them into such pure devotees. O great preacher of Vedic culture, formerly a great many swamis went to foreign countries, but now you have wonderfully preached the Sankirtan movement and the sublime philosophy of Bhakti Kot in the Western countries. And that is the only means for giving peace and prosperity to all people of the world in this age. For preaching religion and culture, your holy name will remain ever dazzling. To speak frankly, we feel a very intimate relationship with you, and we feel perfect satisfaction at this time in the privilege to present you this address of welcome. We take it for granted that you are one of us in Vrindavan. We are sure that wherever you travel, you must carry with you the impression of Sri Vrindavan Dham. The culture, religion, philosophy, and transcendental existence of Sri Vrindavan Dham travel with you. Through the great message your holiness carries, all the people of the world are now becoming very intimately related with Vrindavan Dham. We are certain that through your preaching alone, the transcendental message of Vrindavan will spread all over the world. May you be crowned with a success in these noble activities. So Prabhupada spoke after that, and he explained that the basic philosophy of Krishna consciousness, that we shouldn't consider ourselves Hindu or Christian or Muslim. We consider ourselves servants of Krishna. And Prabhupada foresaw that even though this very glowing address was given to him, that there would be some tension in Vrindavan, because there were caste Goswamis who had taken over the worship of the major temples in Vrindavan. Of course, the original founders of the temples were actual Goswamis, the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, but they had Grihastha disciples, and they entrusted the worship of these temples to their disciples. And the disciples would give that service to their children, to their children, to their children. That way there was a hereditary dynasty for each temple. And they felt that one must be a Brahmin to be qualified to worship. Previously, in 1932, Prabhupada's spiritual master had organized a parikrama around Vrindavan, and he had initiated people as Brahmins who were not born into Brahminical families. And there was a lot of resistance at that time to that sort of propagation of Krishna consciousness. People did not accept that you could become a Brahmin if you were not born in a Brahmin family. And that mood was still there at this time, and Prabhupada foresaw that that would be a problem. So right from the beginning, he addressed that. And then at the end of the talk, he said that they would like to establish a temple, a Hare Hare Krishna, the International Society for Krishna Conscious Temple, in Vrindavan, and if anyone had any land, they should please come forward and see him. And lo and behold, someone came forward and saw him. Said they had some land in Ramanreti, and they wanted to devote it to the worship of Radha and Krishna, and they were ready to donate it to someone who would build a temple for Radha and Krishna on that land. And that became what is now our Krishna Balaram temple eventually. There were obstacles in the way, but at that time, at that very lecture where Prabhupada responded to this glowing address, he canvassed for land, and land actually manifest. Here I can read Satsrup Maharaj's understanding of this, what I'm trying to explain. Prabhupada was aware that behind the formal reception and ceremonial words of Vrindavan's prominent citizens dwelt a deeper feeling of reserve and even suspicion, especially among the caste Goswamis, the proprietors of Vrindavan's major temples. While accepting Srila Prabhupada's foreign disciples as devotees of a sort, many Vrindavan residents nevertheless felt reluctant to accept foreign Vaishnavas as Brahmins, sannyasis, and pujaris. This misunderstanding was due to a traditional Hindu concept. Only those born in caste Brahmin families could become Brahmins. So this is Prabhupada stepping out onto the courtyard of Radha Damodar, offering his obeisances to the Lord. There. His pranams. Then a morning walk in Vrindavan. So Prabhupada personally took us at this time to the holy places in Vrindavan. It's the end of Kartik, it was November. Let's see. Going through the streets of Vrindavan with Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada took us to the bank of the Yamuna where he bathed. First he was sitting on the side and said he was an old man. It was too cold for him to bathe. But when he saw the devotees in the water, he became very intrigued and decided to go in as well. Now this is Prabhupada sitting in his quarters at the Radha Damodar temple. This is where he sat to translate the first three volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam. And he's talking to a person named Gaurachand Goswami, who, as I mentioned, he's a descendant. Descendant means Jiva Goswami, the founder of Radha Damodar Temple, had Grihastha disciples who had children, who had children, who had children. So this is one of the descendants in that way of the disciples of Jiva Goswami. And you'll notice that Prabhupada's eyes are closed. Ordinarily, when you see a picture like that, you think the person just blinked at that time. But actually, Prabhupada had his eyes closed. You'll see in all these pictures, Prabhupada has his eyes closed. He was speaking to Gaurachand Goswami with closed eyes. Gaurachand Goswami is a bridge bossy, so he's very exalted, but in another way of looking at him, he was not a very savory character. He didn't, for instance, follow all the regular principles and things like that. At the Radha Damodar temple, Prabhupada told the devotees of his plan for an ISKCON temple in Vrindavan, and he suggested to the Radha Damodar pujari that ISKCON use the Radha Damodar temple. "We shall prepare the whole temple nicely," Prabhupada said, "and we shall make a silver throne for the deity. 50 to 100 men will take prasadam here. It will be unique. If you want to, we can do it. Otherwise, we can start our own temple somewhere. We are prepared to spend money. If you give us a chance, we'll spend it here. We want to make this a great festival in Vrindavan because it is Jiva Goswami's place. Rupa Goswami and Jiva Goswami sat here. We have literature, we have books. Everyone is associating with us all over the world." prophet speaking from his eyes closed. He was very strong with him. You can see that. You can see there he's not about to compromise with Gaurachand Goswami. And Gaurachand Goswami finally submits in some way to Srila Prabhupada. Becomes more relaxed. This is from the other angle. The same conversation from the other angle. So, with your permission, I can read some of the devotees' remembrances from this time in Vrindavan. This first one is from Jamuna. His divine grace was very frequently the indication of how much he wanted his rooms at Radhadamodar maintained nicely. He was extremely fond of his quarters there. One night during his stay in Sarafbhavan, he agreed that he would stay for a 24-hour period within his rooms at Radhadamodar temple. It was a very exciting event for all of us to look forward to. He selected three or four men to accompany him to spend the night there at Radhadamodar temple. Sarafbhavan was some distance from Sevakunj, where the Radhadamodar temple is located. During the very early hours of the morning, I walked through the streets of Vrindavan and arrived at the Radhadamodar temple. Inside of Srila Prabhupada's sleeping room, I could see the light coming through the latticed red stone windows and the wooden shutters. Back and forth, he was walking and chanting. Suddenly, very much to my surprise, the wooden shutters burst open and a shaft of light filled a small corner of the courtyard. Prabhupada stood in his room under one bare light bulb. When he saw me, he asked, "How have you gotten here?" I said that I had walked. "Oh, this is not good," he said. "It is very dangerous in the street. There are so many wild dogs and there are dacoits. In this quarter, a man will kill even for a lota, a water pot." So there was some chastisement from Prabhupada on the one hand, but on the other hand, he seemed pleased. "So you were chanting japa," he said, and I said, "Yes," to the Prabhupada. He said, "That is very nice. So go to the samadhi of Rupa Goswami and chant there." Then around 4 o'clock, other pilgrims were starting to filter in to attend the morning aarti program. Prabhupada came out where we were chanting, and he said that this corner of Radhadamodar temple was just like the hub of the wheel of the spiritual world. It was the center. He requested that his rooms always be well maintained and that they be cleansed daily. Now I have quite a long remembrance by Radhanath Swami. Do you have the patience to hear? I had only met Srila Prabhupada briefly in Bombay, and then I had gone alone to live in Vrindavan. I had lived there about 6 months with the local people, and it was there that I got real attached to Krishna consciousness. I used to live just on the bank of the river with all the Babajis, a very simple life. I know it was just by that initial contact with Prabhupada that the seed was planted. One day, a big bus full of American devotees having a kirtan pulled into Vrindavan. And I was thinking, oh, here they are again. The first thing I asked was, "Is Prabhupada coming?" And they said, "Yes, Prabhupada is here. He will be speaking tomorrow morning." I was already attracted to a lot of gurus in Vrindavan, Prabhupada's godbrothers and also devotees from other sampradayas. But on the morning when I came for the Bhagavatam class and heard Prabhupada chanting Jai Radha Madhava, I just sat there and listened. I had never seen anyone with such a quality of love for Krishna. All the great people I had met in India became insignificant when I saw Prabhupada chanting Jai Radha Madhava. He was so serious and grave, and the quality of his devotion was so intense. I just couldn't believe it. He kept looking over at me every now and then, kind of nodding, because I guess he remembered me from Bombay. Then he spoke, and he was glorifying Vrindavan so nicely. He was talking about how wonderful Vrindavan is, how spiritual the atmosphere is, and he was talking about how careful the devotees must be to take advantage of the atmosphere. From that day, I started thinking, this is my Guru Maharaj. Just because of the way he spoke, his lecture had been so precise and inclusive that it had encompassed every other philosophy and every other teacher I had ever heard. I could also see that Prabhupada's example was pure, and I could see his disciples were actually giving up sinful life. I used to go to his darshans every day, although I was still living on the bank of the Jamuna. All the people of Vrindavan were glorifying Prabhupada. They were so proud of him because the people of Vrindavan are attached to Vrindavan. They love Krishna, they love Vrindavan because Vrindavan is the place where Krishna lives. That's their mood. They worship the land of Vrindavan. But they would tell me they appreciated Prabhupada. Most of them would call him Swami Bhaktivedanta. They would say he's the greatest saint because he is bringing Vrindavan all over the world. He's making the glories of Vrindavan known to the whole world. Then one day, Prabhupada and his disciples went to an ashram in Ramanreti. I got there late, just as Prabhupada was leaving. He was walking the last 20 yards or so to his taxi. And many Brijvasis were offering their full dandavats on the road. I felt very insignificant, another member of the crowd. And as Prabhupada walked by me, I offered my full obeisances also. When I lifted my head to get up, however, I saw Prabhupada's feet were right there in front of me. I thought, oh my God, Prabhupada is standing right there. I very slowly looked up, and Prabhupada was just standing there looking right at me. He looked me in the eyes for a couple of seconds and then said, so how long have you been living in Vrindavan? I said, about 6 months, Srila Prabhupada. He just looked at me again, and he was in a very serious mood, very compassionate, gazing into my eyes. He nodded his head and said, do you like it here? This is the most wonderful place I've ever been in my life. And all of a sudden, his serious expression just blossomed into the most beautiful smile. His eyes were glistening radiantly, and he looked at me for about 5 or 10 seconds. It seemed like a real long time. I couldn't believe the mercy he was giving me. And then he just replied, that is very nice. Vrindavan is a wonderful place. And he walked on. This was very special for me because most of the devotees were always telling me I was in Maya staying in Vrindavan. And because I was kind of attached to my own program in Vrindavan, I was feeling that the devotees didn't understand and I was upset with them, thinking they didn't appreciate the atmosphere. But Prabhupada's words alleviated all my anxieties toward the Hare Krishna movement. It was the most special personal contact. It wasn't what Prabhupada was saying, it was his personal transcendental concern for me. So then I went to his classes every day and all the darshans, and there was no doubt in my mind. He very much convinced me on every level of Krishna consciousness. When Prabhupada left, the devotees told me I should join and go on parikrama with them all around India. And they said that Prabhupada had personally invited me to come. I was unbelievably appreciative that Prabhupada was so merciful. But at the same time, I was very attached to Vrindavan. I told them I just wanted to stay here. And if they ever came back, I would serve Prabhupada here. And that I didn't want to leave Vrindavan. Soon after that, my visa expired. I had to leave the country. But before I left, the people of Vrindavan, especially the Babajis, were telling me that Bhaktivedanta Swami had established new Vrindavan. In the West, they said, if you have to leave Vrindavan, you should go to New Vrindavan. So whatever you do, don't leave Vrindavan. New Vrindavan and Old Vrindavan are the same because Swami Bhaktivedanta has created Vrindavan in the West. They said it with great pride, so I left for New Vrindavan. So Prabhupada was training us while we were there in Vrindavan. He would say that anything that we did wrong would be a reflection of him. Even if we used a lota improperly, it would reflect on his training of us. And he asked us to be very careful about that. This is Prabhupada in his rooms at Radhadamodar. On the right is his original danda, sannyas danda. This is what Prabhupada wrote in a letter to one of his disciples. I am currently in Vrindavan with a party of 40 devotees, and we are having daily parikrama of the holy places. We shall return to Delhi tomorrow by coach. The officials and residents of Vrindavan have greeted us very nicely and are simply astounded to see our Sankirtan party chanting with great jubilation through the city streets. The mayor has publicly proclaimed that I have done something wonderful. And practically speaking, they realized that before I went to the Western countries, no one there knew about Vrindavan. Now hundreds of visitors and hippies from your country come here to see Krishna's place. The Vrindavan devotees have understood that Vrindavan is now world famous due to my preaching work. So they all very much appreciating their hometown Swami. So I was there in my state of semi-belief or semi-disbelief, just in the middle there, and trying to grapple with my own faith and what I was going to do with my life. And I realized that faith is something that can't be trifled with. It's a very serious thing. Trifled with. It's not something. Trifled? Trifled means it's not a small thing. You have to treat it with great respect and honor. You're Spanish speaking? Anyone speak Spanish? They know the word trifle? So, I was going through this in my own life and reflecting how Providence sent me to Vrindavan, Yadavara, and John and I at that time, first, and Vrindavan had so infiltrated my lack of faith that I finally woke up. Maybe there is something beyond just what we can perceive with our senses. And now I had the incredible, just amazing experience of being in Vrindavan with Srila Prabhupada. Perhaps many of you saw the disappearance film that we showed. There's one devotee there speaking, Shamananda, an Australian devotee. And he also mentions how Vrindavan is transforming. And when Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, it's just overwhelming. The experience is overwhelming. So that's what I was going through myself. And so we're in November now, 1971. And I first lived in the temple in Brooklyn about 14 months before that, 15 months before that. So for me, considering what I was going to, what I was becoming, that was actually a very short time, you know, less than a year and a half. I was going from complete faithlessness to becoming an aspiring devotee of Krishna. So I wrote here my reflections on that change. Faith, I discovered, cannot be trifled with. She must be honored like an aristocratic guest in one's home. Ignored, she will find other, more worthwhile places to reside. Respected, she will flourish and do miracles. My faith had carried me from the fantastic idea that life originated from matter to the fantastic idea that a supreme being is the cause of all life and of all things. Both the atheistic and the theistic concepts are beyond comprehension. But when looked at squarely, the theory that atoms combine to make molecules, which combine to become cells, which combine to eventually become a human being, is just not just far-fetched, it eradicates purpose. It creates a devastating vacuum of meaning. The theory of evolution, stripped of its scientific aura and standing naked, is farcical. Meanwhile, when I accept a supreme being, the creation I formerly saw as empty and purposeless fills with the preternatural, like the preternatural fills with the spiritual. Like a barren field suddenly covered in spring poppies, or a ravenous person satiated by a hearty vegetable stew on a winter day. In our first visit, Vrindavan had captivated me by the piety of her residence. This time, under Prabhupada's tutelage, I am captivated by the sweet, bottomless mystery of God, the supreme cause of everything, who appears as a mischievous village child and who charms his devotees, agrarians and cowherds. And who is to stop him? Who is to claim that God can't or shouldn't have or wouldn't? Which audacious person can bar God from being among those he loves and who love him without reserve? I now shrink from being that proud and foolhardy person. In Vrindavan, with Srila Prabhupada, I somehow feel the presence of the inconceivable and sense that I am something more than matter. I do not understand how my doubts lift, but I am not sad to see them go. So Prabhupada takes us on a tour of the holy places. This is Barshana. We spent a day in Barshana. Perhaps I can introduce you to some of the devotees. This is Kiravakshaya Vishnu, one of the few Indian disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Gurudas, Prabhupada, no, Srila Prabhupada. Bhargavuni, Gautama Swami, brother of Prabhupada. Shamsundar, not Krishna, that's not her, this is Guru Kripa, that's Brahmachari. This particular temple, the Pujaris are very aggressive as far as wanting donations. And they were, even with Srila Prabhupada, he gave a donation and they hounded him for more. And he just totally ignored them, like they weren't even there, like they were invisible. He didn't say yes, he didn't say no, he gave what he felt was the proper amount to give. And then for him, they didn't even exist. So in that way, of course, he didn't offend them in any way. And it's a very steep hill up, as probably many of you know. So Prabhupada rode in this palanquin. And at first, on the way up, the devotees were all excited to carry the palanquin, which they did, as you can see. On the back is Narayan Dasadikari. And on the right, that another Indian disciple, one of the few, is Manasvi. They carry him up this hill. Prabhupada said that, of course, Radharani used to live there, and he pointed out a hill far away where he said Krishna would stay. And there was a forest in the middle, and he said Radha and Krishna would meet in that forest between those hills. And here they're going up. See how high it is? The devotees are having a kirtan as we go. Narayan tends to be very dramatic. That on the left is Tejas's wife, Madeira. This is coming back. We circumambulated. And you'll see that for going down, or even here, the devotees realized that they weren't really qualified to carry the palanquin, so they gave it to the Indian palanquin carriers who were much better at it than they were. Prabhupada was less inconvenienced. So here they are carrying it down. Very steep, long steps. This here is a devotee named Sunathi. Now we're leaving the temple. See, Saraswati's also there in the front, smiling for the camera. Also, we went down another place of parikrama. We saw Krishna's footprint, which was very large. And we asked Prabhupada about that. How could his footprint be so large? And Prabhupada said, actually, at that time, people were larger than they are now. They're quite small by comparison. That's Gurdas with the camera. We were waiting visiting the temple, we were waiting for the car to come. So now it's towards the end of November, 1971. And there's going to be a initiation and marriage ceremony, November 29th, 1971. There were two couples married, Mani Bandar and Kanta, who had recently come from America, and also Yadavara and his girlfriend Jean. And Jean is first initiated. Prabhupada preferred to marry disciples. He didn't want to marry people who were not yet initiated. So I was first to get initiated, and then right after that, be married. So just 5 weeks before that, if you remember, we were in the Calcutta temple, and I had become fed up with Krishna consciousness because of all the problems in the Calcutta temple, and was about to leave. And here it is just a short time later, and I'm plunging in to Krishna consciousness. So in one sense, I really wasn't ready. you could say. I really had very little understanding of the philosophy, although I'd heard Prabhupada, and it hadn't all made sense to me yet. And I was more or less swept away by Prabhupada's presence and by being in Vrindavan. That's the sad fact, or the happy fact, however you want to look at it. So, I can read to you the description of what happens for this episode here. Although Jean's faith is dim and pliable, she is propelled by the euphoric impetuousness of youth. Does she have a grasp of the tradition and culture she is entering? Vaguely at best. Jean is caught up by the place, by the circumstances, and especially by Srila Prabhupada. Does she consider entering other religious traditions like Christianity or Judaism? To her, the path matters less than the guide. She has found a guide she can follow without hesitation. So before Prabhupada handed me the beads, as he did in all the initiation ceremonies, he asked me for the four rules and regulations, which I was able to rehearse. So I was able to tell him that. And I could only reflect on how that standard separated him from all the other religious leaders that I knew of. No one else asked those four rules and regulations of their disciples. And in one sense, it's an austerity, especially living in this world at this time. But in another sense, it's the most wonderful thing because it means Prabhupada wanted to preserve the purity and the seriousness of this movement. He was not going to be cheap. For every single initiated disciple, they must agree to these four rules and regulations, and there was no compromise. So, this singular standard separates Srila Prabhupada and Krishna consciousness movement from almost every other religious movement on earth. Have I stumbled into something crazily depriving or something authentic? Something that will disappoint me or something I can trust? Am I following my heart or my head? Or neither, or both. It's overwhelming. I have not thought very well or very thoroughly about these four vows. At best, my thoughts are simplistic. Why blur the senses, why cloud the mind, when God himself is attainable by abstinence and purity, and he is within our grasp, were we but free of self-centeredness and filled with devotional love. With uncharacteristic optimism, I skirt the seriousness of lifelong oaths and the difficulty of bucking the thrust of modern life. Flushed with the beauty and consistency of Krishna consciousness, with the promise and power of Prabhupada's presence, we who were initiated by him had an unstoppable hope. We would follow these rules and regulations for the rest of our lives. Krishna, irresistible Krishna, is Srila Prabhupada. Krishna is yours, you have the power to give him to me. I am simply running behind you, shouting, Krishna, Krishna. So, the next step, of course, in any initiation, Prabhupada asks, how many rounds will you chant each day? Srila Prabhupada solemn looks directly at me. The pupils and irises of his eyes are the same color, as deep as a woodland pond. Those gentle eyes, full of guileless wisdom, know the secret of a rich culture and penetrate layer after layer of externals. I wonder what he is seeing and wish it was better. But anyway, he is accepting me. Although he already has thousands of disciples, and in the years to come he will have thousands of more, at this moment it is just him and me. A long-lost soul is making a momentous, fateful choice. And how many rounds of japa will you chant each day? Nervous yet smug, I say 16. But that same direct look, Srila Prabhupada says, that is the minimum. And then he hands me my shiny, dark brown, smooth beads, made from the holy tulsi tree, from the holiest land of Vrindavan, the place where Srila Prabhupada directed us, and where my spiritual journey began. So here, Prabhupada's coming out of the temple. So then after that was the marriage ceremony. And In this party, there were three photographers. One was Yadavara, who was in the ceremony. One was Vishaka, who was in the ceremony. And the other one was Mani Bandar, who was also in the ceremony. So the result was that Malati, who was the cook, she ran up in the middle of cooking and grabbed the camera, my camera, and took a picture. And this is the one picture that we have from this event, by the grace of Malati. So Malati also, I don't know if you know Malati, she is a very industrious person, and unstoppable person. And she, of course, had seen many wedding ceremonies in India by this time, and she realized that the tradition was that the woman gets this mindi on her hand. So she wanted to do that for me also, and you see, she's done that. Unfortunately, she didn't have henna, which is what's traditionally used. She had something else. And she didn't have the fine little brush that they use. So the lines are about a half inch thick. And when I did Achman as part of the ceremony, I looked at my knee and it was red. And my first thought was, why has my knee started to bleed? And then I realized that the dye that she had put in my hand had run up. It was not water resistant. So my knee was turning red very quickly. So she ran and got a cloth from somewhere and we kind of wiped that up. And the ceremony went on. Gurdas was the pujari for that, or the priest for that. And meanwhile, Prabhupada was sitting, and Amalati didn't include him, but he was sitting on the left there on that raised dais. And Radhanaswami said he was also present at that time, although I was not conscious of that. So, Gurdas gave a talk about the relationship between the husband and wife, and we did the usual with the bananas into the fire. Now, I could mention at this point, this is something quite unusual. I didn't put it in the memories, but I just felt when I'm speaking to devotees, I mentioned this, that this other couple that was getting married, Mani Bandar and Kanta, Mani Bandar had already been married, and for whatever reason, he had given up his first wife. And he had gotten involved with Kanta, his second wife, and Kanta was already obviously pregnant. So Mani Bandar had gone to Prabhupada and said, you know, I want to marry this woman. And Prabhupada was in a bit, I mean, you can see from his point of view that, first of all, Mani Bandar had already given up this other woman. So, you know, he couldn't very well tell him to go back. And in addition, it becomes more complicated that this second woman was already with child. So it was an awkward position because you can't say no because he's already a father. And you don't want to say yes because it's such a dishonorable situation. So what to do? This is not, of course, this specific thing was unique, but very often Prabhupada's disciples would put him in these very difficult situations. And so Prabhupada was brilliant, actually, what he did. It took me a long time to figure it out. But he told Gurdas to do their ceremony. We had two fireplaces, right? Two sacrificial fires. They sat at one and we sat at the second one. He instructed Gurdas to do the entire ceremony for Mani Bandar and Kanta first. It means all the mantras were said, the bananas were in the fire, everything was done. Then, at that time, Prabhupada came out of his room and sat on that dais to be present for our ceremony, initiation ceremony. So without saying a word, he made a very clear statement that he did not approve, but it was going on because of the inevitability of what Mani Bandar had done. And, you know, he was present for our... It was quite extraordinary. Actually, I was so new at this time that I thought that for these ceremonies, you're supposed to have a fire for each different couple. I didn't realize till much later what Prabhupada had arranged in this particular circumstance. So, not one family member or relative has attended my initiation and marriage. And except for Yadavara, no one from my school days. The only guests present are those who just happened to be there. We hadn't invited anyone, yet I miss no one. I have stepped out of my past so completely that I haven't even informed those who have been in it. Neither do I think of my future. The present fills my existence, and I want nothing but more of it. Srila Prabhupada, of the reality he presents, of the culture he propounds. Both my parents had rejected religious rituals as meaningless. I embrace it as a window to reality. They both had abruptly left their tradition-filled heritage. Just as abruptly, I leave the tradition-less heritage they had given me. So my parents, my mother was part of the Roman Catholic Church of England, the Anglican Church, and she had just seen rituals without any philosophy and thought it was irrelevant to her life and left it as a young woman. And my father was brought up in a very strict Judaic tradition, also with no philosophy, just rituals, and he also had left it at a young age. So my brother and I were raised as atheists. My need for Srila Prabhupada's presence is so great that I cannot foresee a world in which he is not present somewhere, untiringly piercing the material masquerade and smashing its illusion of happiness, yet possessing a healthy love for the world as a gift from God. Prabhupada, who is completely his own person, yet unswervingly loyal to a tradition, through the tradition he lives, who is steeped in that tradition, yet whose vision is always fresh, never hackneyed, stereotyped, or predictable. Prabhupada, who marks vast social, political, and historical degenerative cycles and daily confronts his followers' failings, yet remains ever hopeful, ever patiently revamping our spoiled dispositions. Prabhupada, who insists that we, his students, know who God is, know who we are, know how the material energy operates, and know the consequences of our acts, karma. Prabhupada, who unceasingly, untiringly, repeatedly inundates us with divine philosophy. Srila Prabhupada's message is simple, practical, and earth-shaking, and when he initiates me, it is as much an end of my first 21 years as it is the beginning of the rest of them. The tsunami, with its new thoughts, values, attitudes, priorities, diet, dress, schedule, and habits, has hit the beach, and my former habits must recede. So this is, now it becomes December of 1971, and India has just allied with East Pakistan in the Bangladesh Liberation War. So we go from Vrindavan to Delhi. This is our honeymoon, and it's a city besieged by war. So maybe we can stop there for a break. It's been a long time. Maybe if there's any comments or discussion points, I should say. Considered that I was not qualified to say what was mythology or not mythology. But I had to accept the authority of Prabhupada, accept the authority of the literature, the scriptures that he was speaking from. That for me to say that Vivaswan's book to Manu's book to Dwaka was false, I mean, who am I to say that it's false? I don't have that capacity. It's beyond me. Very arrogant stance to take. So, based on Prabhupada's presence and his presentation of Krishna consciousness, you could accept his statements, his authority. Okay, thank you for your attention. Great for a walk.